right now, let's bring in Dr. Angela Rasmussen. I've been taking care of business. It's all right. Taking care of business. Oh, Dr. Rasmussen, I'm glad you got time for us because you're everywhere these days.
You are.
Everywhere.
Well, I'm always happy to make time for you guys.
Thank you.
Hey, really appreciate that. All right, let's get to it. On Friday, Dr. Rasmussen, the White House announced Operation Warp Speed with a promised vaccine by the end of the year. And yesterday, the drug maker Moderna announced all 45 people in their initial vaccine trial were producing antibodies after the first dose. So can you explain vaccine reliability?
Yeah. So while everybody got really excited about the Moderna data yesterday, I think it's a good sign, but people should be cautious. A lot of people in this discussion have sort of confused just having antibodies with meaning that you are, in fact, completely protected and immune. And that's not always necessarily the case. So right now, a lot of scientists are working very hard on this question to try to figure out what antibodies actually mean in terms of if you will be protected. The bottom line for the Moderna vaccine and for all the other vaccines in development is that it's great to know that people are producing antibodies in response to the vaccine, but we now need to move to the next step to actually see if those antibodies are protective.
Do you see there being any possibility of a vaccine being maybe rushed to the market with like some shady testing that's either unsafe or only marginally effective?
Oh, that's my biggest concern, especially when the president, who is not really known for necessarily spreading the best medical information all the time, is talking about Operation Warp Speed. One very serious risk of that is that a vaccine might have side effects that you wouldn't necessarily observe in a small population, such as that used for a phase one trial, only 45 people. That's really an extremely low number of people when you're talking about a vaccine that needs to work in everybody, all the millions, hundreds of millions of people in the U.S. population, the billions of people around the world. So my concern is that a vaccine could go out en masse, like to the entire population, that either doesn't work and gives people a false sense of security or has side effects that are really unacceptable, when we should be putting all of our money and resources into a vaccine that we know will work and will be safe to use.
Doctor, yesterday the president surprised many by saying that he is taking hydroxychloroquine and he is doing it. He's not COVID positive, but he's doing it to try to prevent the virus. And we have talked about the risks, but I hadn't heard anything about any evidence that it helps in preventing the virus.
That's because there is no evidence that it does prevent getting the virus or treating with it early. In fact, most of the data that's come out of the hydroxychloroquine clinical studies so far suggests that it has a very mild effect, if any effect at all. Now, that may be different in a prophylactic setting where you're trying to prevent it. It's possible that some of the antiviral effects that were observed in experimental models might have more of an effect early on in infection, protecting a person from being exposed. But the bottom line is we just don't have any evidence right now that supports that.
And the president also mentioned, he said, you'd be surprised by how many people are actually taking it, kind of inferring that many doctors are taking it themselves, and that that it's so basically easily available. Is it that easily available? Like if I decided, oh, not that I would, and I wouldn't, but you know that I wanted to try it in case it could help me. I mean, is that something that you can just get that easily?
Well, in normal times, with a prescription, certainly it was easily available. It's a generic drug. It's been around for a really long time, as the president has pointed out. And it's used to treat, it used to be used to treat malaria, but now most malaria is actually resistant to it. So it's usually used here either to prevent malaria or to treat lupus or rheumatoid arthritis. So it was relatively available, but since hydroxychloroquine has become part of this discussion about COVID, people have also reported shortages of it. So you could get it conceivably with a prescription, depending on where you're at, but that really has to do with drug supplies. And that is a concern that people are just taking it, because that could potentially take the drug away from people who do need it to treat lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or these other medical conditions.
You got to help us understand something. The CDC released a study of COVID-19 in feces, finding that live virus is present in human stools. And basically, in order for people to venture outside the home and the economy to reopen, we'll probably need to trust public restrooms. Dr. Rasmussen, does this technically mean that in order for me to sit on a toilet, I need to clean and disinfect it before I sit down? Help us understand.
I don't think so. That's not, in my opinion, the real concern with that finding. But first of all, I'd like to say that study, which I tweeted about extensively yesterday, did show that there was infectious virus in the stool of two patients. That doesn't necessarily mean that every person who's infected with SARS coronavirus 2 is going to have a lot of infectious virus in their stool. The big concern here is not so much touching a toilet that somebody has used, but the potential for aerosolizing the fecal matter that's in the toilet that might have virus in it. And the reason this is a concern is that during the original SARS epidemic in 2003, there was an apartment building in Hong Kong that had faulty sewage lines. And it's thought that there was a large outbreak of SARS in this complex because of people flushing their toilets and creating these toilet plumes, they're called, of basically big fountains of aerosolized material that's in the toilet. People breathed that in and were infected with SARS. So it's possible that something like that could happen here, but it is worth pointing out that that was because of a faulty sewage system. It was not normal toilets operating. So it's definitely a concern. It's something we need to look into more. But I think that closing the lid or minimizing the amount of time that you're spending in a public restroom for now is probably a good precaution to take. We really don't know what the risk is of transmission in this form.
Usually I ask you good news question during the course of our interview, so I'll go ahead and take that time right now. What kind of good news do you have for us on the show?
So some good news today, or actually late last night, the South Korean Center for Disease Control reported that in these cases of supposed reactivation, so these were patients that were infected and had COVID and then recovered and tested positive again, none of those patients actually had any infectious virus in their swabs. So that means that while the test was detecting some residual virus genetic material, it was probably pretty low. And they weren't actually producing any infectious virus, meaning that they're not carrying the virus for a long time and transmitting it to people. So that's very good news. When you recover from COVID, you're not likely to present a transmission risk to the people around you.
So some of our listeners have come up with some good questions, and I'm going to ask you a couple of them right now. In case anyone has any additional questions, you can text us right now at 98973. So, Doctor, here is the first one. How big of a risk do we have of contracting COVID-19 through our eyes? We're told to wear masks, but not protective eyewear. Should we be wearing some kind of protective eyewear?
So that's a really excellent question. And unfortunately, my answer is I don't know what the actual risk is. So the eyes are an interesting part of the body, and that is they have a special immune status. So when your immune system normally gets triggered by an infected cell, the first response is that it will go try to kill that cell. You can't do that in your eyes because obviously if you start killing the wrong kind of cells in your eyes, your retinal cells, you could go blind. So you don't want to have that happen in your eyes. So the eyes have other defense mechanisms that don't rely on cell killing to clear infections, which means that they may be actually less susceptible to viruses getting in that way. But the bottom line is that for SARS coronavirus 2, we just don't know. I think that it's a face shield or eye protection are a good potential measure to take. Certainly, it can't hurt. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to many people who actually say that they would prefer to wear a face shield over a face mask because it's either more comfortable or it feels more natural to talk to somebody wearing a face shield. And I honestly think that's fairly reasonable. My stepson works in a grocery store, and he's been given the option of a face shield or a face mask while he's working, and he chose a face shield, and I think that that is an adequate form of protection. It's not perfect, but neither is a face mask.
Right. Okay, here's another one. I'm a dental hygienist. I work with spit all day long, and I am scared to go back to work. The governor has given the okay for them to go back. Does opening dental offices seem safe at all to you? And I would just add, you know, how can someone who is going to work in that environment be as safe as possible?
So that is definitely a situation, in my opinion, that people who are working in dentistry, who are going to be up close and personal with people's faces, who are potentially at risk of being exposed not only to respiratory droplets, but also potentially to aerosols generated by certain dental procedures, that those people should have more comprehensive PPE. So they should be issued N95 masks. They should have eye protection and face shields. So I think that it could be safe, but those people need to have the proper protective equipment in order to safely do their jobs.
That is the voice of Dr. Angela Rasmussen as she joins the G and Ursula show. You know, Dr. Rasmussen, a text came in. By the way, if you have a question for our doctor, go ahead and text us at 98973. And this texter is speaking my language. What's up with massages in the future, Dr. Rasmussen?
My language, too, by the way.
My language, too. I'd love nothing more than to go to the spa and get a massage. That's for sure. I think that in general, with massages, you would probably want to take the same precautions that you would take in any kind of business, like a hair salon or even a restaurant where you are going to have people that aren't going to be able to maintain physical distancing. So at minimum, you would probably want a massage therapist to be wearing a surgical mask, and you might consider wearing one as well to protect the massage therapist. Mm-hmm. Ideally, you would want everybody to have access to the type of PPE that I just described for a dental assistant or a dentist. But that may not be possible given the shortage of things like N95 masks. So I would say that probably at minimum, people should be wearing surgical masks for massages.
Baseball right now, there's talk about that reopening. Basketball is being talked about. The Houston Rockets, they're going to be showing back up to their practice facility starting on Monday. Can you kind of give us a thought? So let's just go with baseball right now. Give us your thoughts on baseball reopening.
So I think a lot of this does depend on the sport, because obviously for none of these sporting events, as far as I'm aware, have any plans to bring fans back, which is, in my opinion, one of the biggest risks. Because if you have people in a crowd, certainly I have Seahawks season tickets, and you know, I know how we all stand up and scream when the other team has the ball. That is a great opportunity for mass transmission, unfortunately. So I think, you know, first of all, no sport can consider right now bringing back the fans. But when you're talking about the players and player safety, that does really kind of depend on the inherent physical contact involved in that sport. So something like basketball or football is going to be more challenging in terms of protecting the players than for baseball, since apart from when they're in the dugout, baseball players usually aren't in close physical proximity with each other very often. I think that in general, it's probably okay to do that as long as physical distancing is observed, and also as long as the league has a plan for minimizing risk to the outside community, meaning that they have some type of testing program where they're going to be able to routinely test players and people who are, you know, going to these practices in the games, the coaching staff, all of the support staff, et cetera. They also should consider having some type of sequestration plan in which the players are potentially staying in hotels, staying away from their families, which is really lousy for the players, but it may actually be safer since they are going to be engaging in physical contact and potentially being at higher risk of exposure.
Doctor, I got a couple more listener questions. Now with gyms, you know, at some point going to reopen again, and we talked about spas. Okay, when you are in their restrooms, there are those handheld blow dryers. Should they ever be allowed after, you know, like once we start reopening, does that increase the risk of spread?
You mean like a
like
hand air dryer?
Yes, exactly. With that blowing around the air.
Those air dryers are interesting because some studies have shown that they actually do a better job of spraying bacterial pathogens anyways around in the environment when people stick their hands under them or into them for those Dyson ones. I think that actually paper towels or those cloth ones that you know, you pull out a fresh piece of cloth and it sort of goes around on a roller, those are probably safer because they're actually generating fewer particles that are going out into the air. But obviously not every place can immediately change their hand dryer situation. I'd say that for any business owner who's really concerned about it, they should consider investing in some paper towels that they can just leave on the counter and encourage people to use.
God, that would be so much more, well, I know it's not better for the environment, but I hate those hand blow dryers. And I just was also thinking of just blow dryer in general, like if you're trying to dry your hair, any issue with that?
Yeah, that really depends. I mean, that's kind of an unknown quantity. And I think some of it will depend on the temperature of the blow dryer. If it's really hot, then conceivably virus wouldn't last a long time. But the bottom line is, I don't think any studies have ever been done on this with really any viruses, much less coronavirus. And I could be wrong about that, but I'm not 100% up on the hairdryer literature.
You've had answers for everything, though. You're awesome. Yeah.
I can speculate, but this is one where I definitely don't know, and I invite any of your listeners to prove me wrong.
Dr. Asmussen, you know what time it is, right?
It's time for the wild card question.
Yes. So here's the deal. Most fights right now are happening for petty, dumb reasons. I've talked about mine on the show. It happens when a lot of people obviously are stressed, anxious about what's going on, living closely together. How did a dumb, petty fight escalate into an all-out war for you?
Well, I can't think of a time, actually, that has happened where my spouse and I have gotten into, I'd say, an all-out war. But we do constantly, we have these little spats that usually have to do with turning on the lights or opening the windows, or me turning on the heat. And one thing that I've gotten into that's kind of my COVID cliche is bread baking. And so I'm always turning on the heat to try to get my yeast to rise faster. And my husband constantly follows me around after me turning down the heat and complaining about the heating bill. And
one more thing we have in common.
Ursula does a lot of baking during this time.
No, I was talking about not the baking. I was talking about husbands who like it cooler in the home.
Yeah. And actually, there have been scientific studies done that show that men and women prefer different temperatures in the ambient environment. So that's maybe one thing that underlies this particular battle of the sexes. But I think in general, it's just when you're living with somebody, like all the time. I mean, in our normal lives, we aren't staying at home 24 hours a day with our spouses or our families or our friends or our roommates. And those little things that come up in everyday life that might irritate you, that wouldn't necessarily be a big deal, keep coming up because you're always around each other. And it's certainly, it's enough of that happens, it builds up and eventually it can snap and result in a fight. I'm just fortunate that so far our marriage remains intact.
You're the best, Dr. Rasmussen. Thank you so much for hanging out with us on the Gina Ursa Show.
My pleasure. Take care, guys.
Thank you.